Second case this morning, Coleman v. Hardy.
May it please the Court.
Just a minute, counsel.
We're back here a second time. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. We're back here a second time before this court on Maurice's case. Significantly, there were three independent sources of proof that Maurice Coleman did not commit the murder of Terrell Jackson.
Could I just start you off, Mr. Chauvin? I hate to come right in like that, but because let's talk about your biggest hurdle, I think, is the district court's credibility findings on the Cades and on Coleman's co-defendant Barnes. So if you could give us your best argument for setting aside those credibility findings, it would be helpful, I think.
I will, Your Honor. I think that the district court committed a couple of critical errors in making these assessments. So, for example, in assessing the credibility of Joseph Barnes, the district court failed to consider what was one of the most significant underlying bases for a trier of fact to have concluded that he was being truthful. And that is that at the time of the original trial, he had told his counsel in private, protected by the attorney-client privilege, that Maurice Coleman was not involved in the murder of Terrell Jackson. So while the court mentioned that fact, what the court failed to consider was the significance of that fact. The court merely characterized that as repeating what Joseph Barnes had said. But the significance wasn't that his attorney wasn't present at the offense. Of course his attorney wasn't present at the offense. The significance of it was that he had absolutely no reason to have told his counsel that if it were not in fact true. And in all the years that this case has been pending, the state has never advanced a reason why he would do that,
well,
were it not true.
Yes, the state has advanced a reason. And that was that Coleman and Barnes were friends, and that Barnes was protecting Coleman. And, he was trying to implicate Roy Wright, the man who fingered Barnes and Coleman. He was saying that Wright and some third man were with him at the murder. And, I mean, see, all in all, Barnes told five different stories.
Your Honor, that might be a reason to suggest why he was coming forward 15 years later and saying those things, which I don't believe the record supports, that they were friends and that he would do it. And there's lots of reasons why that's problematic, not the least of which it hasn't helped him one bit. It hasn't implicated Roy Wright one bit. Roy Wright has not charged with this murder. And so if that was his motive, he certainly hasn't accomplished his goal in either way. But that would not be a reason why he would tell his own attorney in confidence, because telling your own attorney in confidence who really committed the murder, which, by the way, Your Honor, he didn't say to his attorney Roy Wright is the real culprit. He just simply expressed shame, if you will, or sorrow that Maurice Coleman had to get caught up into this because he was truly innocent. So those motives don't explain why he would have told his attorney in private. The other significant flaw, Your Honor, with the way that the district court approached it, is that the district court didn't follow House versus Bell. In other words, she looked at each individual piece in isolation. But to accept the notion that that Maurice Coleman committed this offense, you'd have to believe that the Wilkins brothers, who said it wasn't him on the back porch who committed this crime, who didn't know any of the other people, how would they know what the police would discover? They had no way of knowing, for example, that the Cadys would come forward and say, yes, Maurice was with me, and then thereby present an alibi defense. And they certainly had no way of knowing that Joseph Barnes would later come forward and say it wasn't Maurice Coleman who was involved. So to me, when you look at House versus Bowe, you have to look at all of the evidence because, quite frankly, the Wilkins brothers, which, by the way, the district court, she did not discuss their evidence at all.
They didn't testify, did they?
They didn't testify at the post-hearing, but the two attorneys who interviewed them were unequivocal that they showed them photographs, they interviewed them, and that this they were going to positively say it was not Maurice Coleman on the back porch.
Why didn't they testify? Do you know why they didn't testify?
The one, it's revealed in the record why the one brother didn't testify, and that was because shortly before the hearing, he had been actually arrested on a domestic battery charge and was unavailable. But once the witnesses testified, that is, the attorneys testified unequivocally, that is what he had said to them. Way, not now, not 10 years later, but way back then, there wasn't any reason for us to ask for a continuance to bring him down and to have him repeat what essentially was what they acknowledged, that it was not Maurice Coleman who was out there on August 2nd in front of the house right before the murders.
But isn't another reason because the Wilkins brothers positively identified Barnes, which would bolster the eye testimony of the two people in the house who saw the murder. And those two, of course, identified Barnes and Coleman as the murderers. And Coleman's lawyer was afraid that the Wilkins brothers' testimony would make those two witnesses, on whose testimony the entire case seemed to hinge on, more credible.
Your Honor, that was you've jumped to the ineffective assistance aspect, and that's great, Judge. That reasoning that was articulated by Gary Call has never been accepted by any court, and in fact was not even accepted by the district court below. She simply ignored that testimony and went on to the question of prejudice. And the reasons, I think, are manifold. First of all, it's exactly backward. In fact, the testimony of the Wilkins is corroborated by Arlander, by the victim witnesses, that it was not Maurice. In other words, the assumption that these two witnesses bolstered the witnesses' testimony from inside the house is actually just the opposite, that because all four of the witnesses agreed that Joseph Barnes was the culprit. And so there was no disagreement about Joseph Barnes. What it showed was that the Wilkins brothers were right in their observations, that they had seen what they claimed to see, and they were right that it was Joseph Barnes. The disagreement was on the second identification. Were they right about Maurice Coleman? It would not have supported the state's case at all to show that these two witnesses say it was not Maurice Coleman, and these two witnesses say it was Maurice Coleman. In fact, this court has previously noted that when there are witnesses, some of whom say it was the individual, some who say it wasn't, it's ineffective assistance for the trial counsel to fail to call the exculpatory witnesses, because it gives the jury no basis on which to rest its feeling or its determination that maybe these witnesses are mistaken. Had he called the Wilkins brothers, the jury would have said, hey, wait a minute. Two witnesses who were disinterested, didn't know anybody, were not under the trauma of a home invasion and a murder. They saw clearly who it was, and they agreed
well,
it was Barnes.
How disinterested were they, however? I mean, didn't they have some connection with this whole thing?
They had no connection with Terrell Jackson, no connection with Maurice Coleman, no connection with Joseph Barnes, with the victim witnesses. They were totally independent witnesses. And David Wilkins had been interviewed fully by the police the day after the incident, was taken to a lineup in which Maurice Coleman was involved, and had said he's not one of the two people. So his statement immediately after it excluded Maurice Coleman, his having gone down to the police station excluded Maurice Coleman, and when he met with the two attorneys, it again excluded Maurice Coleman. And the attorneys knew that. And in particular, Maurice Coleman's attorney knew that. And he didn't call either one of those witnesses who fully exonerated him. Now, when you take that, and then you know that the witness also knows that there are two witnesses who are saying he was at home with me, that is, Loretta Katie, she was home with me, and Evelyn said, I called in. Those complement each other. Those don't detract from each other. And so, in our view, he made a further mistake by not calling either one of those, and more importantly, by not even investigating what the alibi defense was. There were things he could have obtained had he tried. He could have gotten airline tickets. He could have gotten receipts. He could have gotten records of the phone call to show.
Am I wrong that the Cades would not testify? They didn't want to testify. Am I wrong about that?
Well, here's you're not wrong about that. The two, Evelyn and Loretta, both said that they were there and willing to testify. What happened was 30 years later at the hearing, Judge Cole said he recalled that they were reluctant witnesses. But so here's where I think when you talk about credibility. So, okay, which recollection is correct? So one way to resolve that is to look at the record evidence. And the record evidence is that 1 month after representing Maurice Coleman, the attorney filed a notice of alibi and identified Loretta Katie as a witness. She's an alibi witness. So he then says he interviews the witness. I can't for the life of me imagine why he would identify Loretta Katie as an alibi witness if she was unwilling to testify. But let's assume that maybe that was his initial impression. 8 months later, he amends the notice, and now he adds Evelyn Cade as a witness. And this is a matter of public record, Your Honor. And then even on the eve of trial, the day before trial, he tells the judge, Evelyn and Loretta Katie are both alibi witnesses, because he wants to make it clear that Evelyn Katie is an alibi witness. Now, why would he tell the judge on the morning, the day before the morning of trial and jury selection, these are my alibi witnesses, if it's true, if his recollection is true, that they were unwilling and reluctant witnesses? And so if the district judge had looked at that record evidence, and of course, Your Honors, your review is de novo, you can look at that evidence. It's in Respondents Exhibit O, Respondents Exhibit Q, and the trial transcript of the original trial at page 187. They're all cited in the briefs. That record evidence shows that his recollection is wrong. They were available.
But couldn't he have been trying to get them to testify and they refused to testify, and so for preserving the record, he lists the two witnesses because he thought they would be alibi witnesses? I mean, he can categorize them, but things do happen. Even on the day of trial, people back out. You know, you've been working on somebody. You think you might get them. They end up saying, no, I'm not going to cooperate.
It's possible. I mean, that would be speculative. But what we know is he never investigated the defense at all in the year that he was representing Maurice Coleman. We also know that he never subpoenaed them to have them present to testify, whether they were reluctant or not. And Your Honors, I can't not say this. Remember that this was a capital case. The state was seeking to put Maurice Coleman to death, and he at least should have investigated that defense. Even if they were reluctant, which I don't believe they were, they said they were not reluctant. They were exactly where Maurice said they would be. And there was lots of other circumstantial evidence that tended to support the alibi defense. But I must say that to not have subpoenaed them, what happens is the next day the jury is told about them in jury selection. Do any of you know them? And then when we get to opening statements, he doesn't advance the alibi defense. So I don't know where along the way he made the decision. He testified that he never intended to put that defense on, which is why he didn't investigate it. But the record evidence belies his recollection of 30 years ago.
I want to ask you about Adamson. What do you think Adamson's motive was? Was Adamson's motive to save Wright by implicating Coleman? Is that your theory?
I think he's mistaken.
Are you saying he would have helped the man who killed his brother because he happened to be dating his sister?
Yeah. It's unclear to me exactly what his motive is. I know this, that when he was asked by the police, do you know of anybody who might have been responsible for this death or have any understanding of why it would have happened, he never mentioned that Roy Wright was there several times during the day, and that Roy Wright was a drug dealer who was involved in a drug deal with my brother. So it would seem to me, and I can't really say, it would seem to me that there was a reason he didn't tell the police that Roy Wright had been there and that Roy Wright was doing a drug deal with his now slain brother. And I think maybe he was afraid of Roy Wright. Maybe he liked Roy Wright. But he certainly knew he had been there. Roy Wright himself even admitted he had been there several times that day and was doing a drug deal with his brother later when he talked to the police. And Roy Wright is sort of that perfect witness who knows everything about everything. In part, I think, because I believe he was involved. That's what Joseph Barnes says. I know he denied it, but that's what Joseph Barnes says in his statements. I see my time is out, Your Honors. We'd obviously ask that you reverse the decision and order a new trial in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schulman. Mr. Meyer?
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Drew Meyer of the Illinois Attorney General's Office, and I represent the respondent appellee, Warden Lemke. Faced with the strong presumption of his guilt, supported by eyewitness testimony that has been credited by the jury, by the state post-conviction court, and by the district court below, petitioner presents no meritorious evidence to meet his burden to demonstrate his innocence so convincingly that no reasonable juror could convict.
Well, there are a few facts here that are just difficult to explain. And I didn't see, an explanation proffered in the briefs. Why would Barnes have told his attorney at the time of trial that Coleman was not involved unless he was not involved?
A couple of responses, Your Honor. First of all, Rhodes testified that during jury deliberations, which was notably 3 days after Barnes' own alibi defense had exploded because the district court allowed Barnes' contradictory Baltimore extradition hearing testimony that Barnes was in Baltimore at the time of the crime into evidence to rebut his perjured Chicago alibi defense, that Barnes told Rhodes, "I feel bad for petitioner because he really didn't have anything to do with it." That statement could mean that it wasn't Coleman's idea and that he was just along with Barnes for the crime, even though he hadn't initiated the idea. But
if
even
you say he didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, even if it's
that
beg your pardon.
Yeah.
No, even if it's not ambiguous, though, Your Honor, both the state and the district court who heard both Barnes and Rhodes testify held Barnes' testimony, and I'll quote from the district court's opinion, Rhodes' testimony does not outweigh the numerous inconsistencies in Barnes' statements or refute the fact that his testimony and averments are unreliable and lack credibility. Secondly, Your Honor, both motives that Barnes had to lie, motives that are factual findings by the state post-conviction court, both that Barnes was motivated by his friendship with petitioner to lie in his favor and motivated by a desire for revenge against Roy Wright, pre-existed his comment to Rhodes. It's possible that this was the embryonic stage of the perjured story that Barnes told in 1995 and tells now. What we do know, based on the credibility determinations of both the state post-conviction court, who heard Barnes testify in 1995, and the district court below, is that Barnes' story is a fabrication. As the court noted in its initial questioning, this court owes deference both to the state post-conviction court's findings in 1995 and beyond, after the evidentiary hearing on petitioner's same actual innocence claim, and absent clear and convincing evidence to the contrary.
See, when I look at the handwritten statement of the two attorneys, Cole and Rhodes, from 1983, it says, quote, Wilkins would testify that defendant Coleman was not one of the two men they saw outside the home of the victim at the time of the shooting. And that doesn't sound equivocal. They didn't say, you know, the Wilkins could not identify the second man as Coleman, but could not exclude him either. What they said was Coleman was not one of the two men they saw. So where is the record evidence that the Wilkins brothers equivocated? Are you relying solely on Patricia Unson's letter?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, Attorney Call at the evidentiary hearing in 2011 clarified, and I quote from his testimony, evidentiary hearing transcript, pages 58 and 59, "I didn't think that either Tracy or David Wilkins could ever get me to the point where they would say, no, he clearly wasn't one of the guys in the house at the time of the shooting." So his evidentiary hearing testimony in this case shows that the testimony is equivocal. And yes, Your Honor, it is powerful evidence that in letters that Coleman received from his own direct appellate counsel, recounting her conversation with his trial counsel, that Geary Call, the trial counsel, explained that the Wilkins, quote, hedged on whether they could state petitioner was not one of the offenders. So the record evidence is clear that the statement in the impounded note signed by Mr. Call and Mr. Rhodes does not tell the whole story. And when one steps back and looks at the entire record, it's clear that the Wilkins brothers could not have excluded Coleman. And very importantly, Your Honor, there is only one fair inference.
Well, one of them did in the lineup, right?
He said that he could not identify him. He did not say that he could not exclude him. And that is in the record because Geary Call elicited it on cross-examination of Chicago Police Detective O'Leary during trial. So the fact that David Wilkins could not identify petitioner as one of the men he saw outside the victim's home near the time of the crime was in the record, and indeed Call emphasized it in closing argument, that petitioner was not one of the men that David Wilkins could identify having seen. But, Your Honor, there is only one fair inference to draw from the fact that petitioner did not call the Wilkins brothers at the 2011 hearing and has not, despite 27 years of litigation, obtained their affidavits, and that is that they cannot exclude him as one of the men they saw. And as this court held in Hayes versus Battaglia, in an actual innocence setting, it's very difficult for a petitioner to prove actual innocence when he merely counters eyewitness testimony with other eyewitness testimony. So, Your Honor, the record shows, the Unson letters in particular show, that the Wilkins brothers did equivocate as to whether they could exclude petitioner as one of the criminals. And, more importantly, even given the opportunity, both in 1995 and by this court in 2011, petitioner has failed to call them, and there is only one fair inference to draw from that fact.
What was the relationship among all these people? Was this I know the drugs were at the heart of the issue here, but what's the relationship of the people that said it wasn't him, and how are they connected with the...
Yes, Your Honor. Well, petitioner's actual innocence claim is a table with no legs at this point, given the district court's credibility determinations. So the two of the people, Evelyn and Loretta Cade, who gave petitioner an alibi in 1999 and 2000 affidavits, 16 and 17 years after the crime, were both found not credible in no uncertain terms by the district court, who heard Loretta testify. The district court also found, quote unquote, very credible Geary Call's evidentiary hearing testimony that when he visited the Cades before trial to check on their alibi, that they told him that we really don't remember whether he was here or not, and that they refused to participate in the defense, which is corroborated by Loretta's admission at the evidentiary hearing that she didn't speak or see petitioner after his arrest, did not attend his trial. It's also supported by the fact that petitioner did not raise counsel's failure to call the Cades on direct appeal.
What about counsel's argument that he had them on, the Coleman's counsel had them on the witness list and then amended the witness list to add the second Cade and was on the final witness list for trial?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, at the evidentiary hearing, Geary Call testified that his strategic reason for putting the Cades on the witness list and keeping them, as Your Honor noted, in trial, and this is what Call testified to, he wanted to keep the option open in case the Cades changed their mind at the last minute and retracted their disavowal of the alibi. And so in order to keep his options open for trial, he kept the Cades on the alibi, on the witness list. And but he also thought that if the state was worried that they would have to deal with this alibi defense, that it would split their focus and dissipate their energy. So it was a strategic choice by Call. Again, as he testified, and I would direct the court to evidentiary hearing transcripts, transcript pages 88 to 89, 105 to 107, 133 to 134. As Geary Call explained, this was a strategic choice on his part to keep the calls or the Cades, I should say, in play. And as far as petitioner's contention that Call did not investigate these witnesses, the record clearly refutes that claim. As Call testified, he investigated, he interviewed both the Cades and the Wilkinses personally to determine the nature of their testimony. And he read the, you know, reviewed the police reports containing the Wilkins brothers' reports of their observations on the day of the crime. Now, it should be noted that the district court found Adamson and Thomas's testimony credible and reliable because they had sufficient opportunity to observe, end quote, docket number 168 at page 31. So again, the district court made a specific credibility determination in favor of the state's evidence. And found Adamson's and Thomas's testimony reliable and consistent. We go into our brief about all the record evidence supporting the district court's determination. But as this court pointed out, petitioner, who has seemingly abandoned his conspiracy theory that Thomas and Wright had a romantic relationship that motivated her to lie about the killer of her stepfather, petitioner offers no reason why either Thomas or Adamson would lie. And so their eyewitness identifications of both Barnes and petitioner remain unrebutted. And petitioner's generalized concerns that he cites in his brief regarding the reliability of eyewitness testimony are demonstrably inapposite in this case, given the fact that there is no question they had the ability to observe, remember, and later identify their attackers because, as we all agree, they correctly identified Joseph Barnes. So if this court has no other concerns or questions about the evidence that I can answer?
Don't believe so. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much. We just asked this court to affirm the holding of the district court. Thank you very much.
Go back to your time had run out, but I'll give you a minute if you have any.
Just two quick corrections, if I could, Your Honors. First of all, Geary Call never said that he was going to try to keep them guessing. That isn't his testimony at all. In fact, he testified that right after the interview with the Cadys that he decided he would not pursue it any further, and that's at page transcript 42 of his of the trial transcript below. Nor was his testimony about equivocation correct. What he said was, the reason, not that the Wilkins equivocated, but that even if 100% of their testimony was believed, that they were never inside the house, so they wouldn't be able to testify what happened inside the house. And that's at page 58 and 59, not that they equivocated in somehow. Just my final point, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes was supposedly famously said that anyone can carve a goose if you remove all the bones. And the central problem with what the district court did below and with what the state is arguing here is they take all the bones out. And so, of course, Joseph Barnes must be lying because he's a liar and he had four stories, without really being able to explain why he would tell his lawyer in secret. What's the significance of that? We'll just throw that bone out. And if you go down again and again and again, anything that is in their favor is fine and truthful. Apparently, even Joseph Barnes is truthful when he says, I did kill Terrell Jackson. And your honors know every day, convictions are sustained based on people who are inveterate, have longer records and more lies than Joseph Barnes. And the reason jurors believe them is because of the totality of the evidence and of the corroborating pieces that show that this Maurice Coleman could not have been there. He was at home with Loretta, and the Wilkins didn't see him there because he wasn't there. And Joseph Barnes confirmed that. And when you put it all together, which House says you must,
thank you, counsel.
It's clear. Thank you.
Case will be taken under advisement, and we move to the